This is a recording of Suresh Naidu on Deconstructing Paracon, a critique of Albert and Hanel's vision of participatory economics. He spoke at the 2004 Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont on September 25, 2004. Over the past 20 years, Michael Albert and Robin Hanel have developed a model for a post-capitalist economic system, one they call participatory economics, also known as Paracon. Some anarchists consider this work to have been a great favor, with Paracon being very explicit about how economics might be organized after capitalism. But others do not see this model as the definitive answer and add that it might not even be a good starting place. In this workshop, Suresh Naidu interrogates the participatory economics vision. He examines the principles of justice underlying Paracon, the style of the vision, and the feasibility of the mechanisms. Suresh Naidu is an economist in training at the University of California at Berkeley. He previously received a graduate degree from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
Before we start, how about we get a go-around and also tell me either if you're familiar with Paracon or what your level of knowledge is, if you're just curious about it and heard it referred to a lot, and if you have read about it, what would you like to know more about, or what are you curious about, and what are your suspicions and hopes?
I guess I am kind of familiar with the Paracon stuff. Not a real expert, and I guess, I'm not really sure what I want to know, except what you have to say about it.
I've only heard it referred to as being controversial, influential, etc., etc. Don't know anything about it, haven't read it yet, and in fact lacked any real grounding in any economic theory.
I've seen it on the shelf and decided not to buy it at the moment, and thought I would find out a bit more by listening to you.
I read a book.
The latest one?
Yeah, I read the latest one.
I just read the latest Paracon book, and I could go on at length about my questions about it, so I'll just not.
I've read portions of the book, and both thought parts of it were really interesting, and parts of it I would like to know more about. So,
I read Moving Forward, one of the earlier ones. That's one of the things I'm interested in, is looking at how you prevent an accumulation of wealth, and also preventing a new managerial classroom.
Mm-hmm. I've read, skimmed some of Michael Albert's writings and heard him talk a couple times. That's about the extent of it.
And I don't know that much about it. I'm interested to learn more.
Great. And I'm Suresh. My only qualifications for this is that I'm an economist, and I've argued with Michael Albert for days on the Z Magazine forums about Paracon. So it's kind of one of these things that sort of continually haunted me throughout my economics training, so I thought I should finally give vent to what I think about it and find out what other people think about it. Okay, so I'm going to start with a diagram that sort of shows the schematic of how Paracon works and then give some highlights. So Michael Albert and Robert Hanel are coming from this 60s radical democratic quasi-Marxist anarchist formation. And so their real big thing to put forward is participatory democracy and egalitarianism. And so they've sort of really read a lot of stuff, and I have to commend them on the fact that they really tried to take what was done in sort of the socialist planning literature and a lot of the sort of economics literature around how did the actually existing socialisms of the USSR work, how could they work, and really tried to implement that with this vision of egalitarian empowered democracy in mind. So they had pretty much had the idea that councils as the basic organizing unit of a society for the economy, it should be that you should have democratic councils for organizing work and for organizing consumption, and then you need to figure out a way of allocating resources among these councils that would sort of preserve an egalitarian distribution. Now, part of what I'd like to talk about is, what do we mean by an egalitarian distribution? What's the principle of justice that we would like the world of the future to look like. And but for now, they want to say that it's reward according to effort. So they say that people should get exactly as much as they, in proportion to how much they work, regardless of talent, property, and anything else. It's just how much do you work, which is not bad for a principle of justice, I think. Okay, so how do they envision this this post-capitalist economy? So on one hand, you have consumer councils, and then on the other hand, you have workers' councils. The really interesting thing, and I think this is a keeper from them, is this balanced job complexes. So partly from Michael Albert's experience with South End Press and some other stuff, they sort of really realized that a big problem with getting sort of democratic workplace councils was that, you know, you had one type of person doing the accounting, and another kind of person, if you maintain sort of the traditional division of labor, you'd have some people doing the accounting, some people doing the janitorial work, and then when you had these sort of group meetings, the people with the accounting knowledge, would their voices would count for so much more, and they'd be so much more well-informed about what was the direction for the firm to take than the people who were doing the janitorial work. And so the idea was to sort of swap around these jobs so that everybody sort of had to take on an equal amount of both bad work and empowering work, so that when the time came to make decisions about the workplace, that everybody could participate in them with sort of at least a modicum of equality. So, and the interesting thing with the consumer councils is that they do what economists call internalize externalities. So what does that mean? So let's say you have a bunch of consumer councils down here. And let's say, and so within a consumer council, you know, we all meet, and I say, well, you know, I'd like a diesel car. And people are like, ooh, but that puts pollution in the environment. And then they're like, we can't make a decision on our own about what to do with that pollution. So they move it up to the next, so they, let's say that this is, that these are all the councils in a given city, that's all the people that, say, are affected by the pollution. They have a higher level council with representatives from all of those that then they get to decide about whether or not this council's request for a diesel car should be approved. So I think I skipped a step, which is, so that's the way councils, the consumption councils work by people.
How did the individual get everyone to agree to? How did you get the rest of your group to agree to ask for a diesel car?
Yeah, so I had to, you know, I had to get them to agree. And so there's a so the way that works is the consumption councils, you're assigned to a consumption council, you get an effort rating from your work council. So your workmates get together and say, you've worked, you know, I say 10 units of hardness. And so that will, and then you come back to your consumption council and you make a request for a certain basket of things that whose value will be like no more than your 10 effort levels. Now, I'll come back to how you compute that valuation in a second, or in a minute. Instead say, okay, so let's say that individuals get together, make proposals about what they would like to consume. The council then votes and approves or disapproves any of these consumption proposals. Any ones that have sort of effects that spill over into other consumption councils get moved up to the next level of consumption. And so, okay, so then let's say that every council has figured out what it wants. Okay, so that's sort of the consumption problem then, is like that once you've found a way of putting together what everybody would like to get, you can sort of have the consumption councils make a proposal. Okay. In the workers' councils, you know, you have these meetings where you decide how much each person has worked. You also make plans about what your inventory is going to be, you know, what your projected output for the next year is going to be. So, okay, let me do this. So from the consumption councils, you get a bunch of demands. Let's call them Ds. You get D1, D2, D3. And from the workers' councils, you get a bunch of supplies, like, because each worker council then decides, okay, we can produce this amount for this amount of labor. And so if you have a whole bunch of workers' councils, you get a bunch of supplies. And Albert and Hanel, who, by the way, are the authors of Paracon, if you haven't figured this out from me babbling about it, it's that these... The idea is that, can we figure out a way of coordinating these two decisions so that the demands equals the supplies? I.e., can we do what markets are supposed to do, but do it in a way that takes care of these externalities, that does it in a way that preserves these council democratic structures, and still maintain the sort of idea that no more is produced than that which people want. And... yeah, and so how do they do that? And this is where they draw on some of this stuff. There's an old debate in economics around called the socialist planning debates, which sort of looked like a bunch of Marxists saying, whatever, central planning is no problem. All you have to do is have the government, if the government knows everything about what everybody wants and what every firm can produce, then the government can just sort of compute what are the prices that that a market would have, just issue those prices, and then have everybody sort of behave as if they were in a market. So the socialist planning debate was, this started in the 1930s with Oscar Lange, if you're interested. And so that was the idea. And then Friedrich Hayek, the sort of famous right-wing Austrian economist, was like, yeah, but there's no way the government could ever get that kind of information. And then the Marxists retorted with, yeah, but there's no way the market gets all that information either. So, and then that's sort of where the debate ended. and it's almost universally acknowledged in the academic literature that the socialists won that debate, that given what the economics of the day said was that there's nothing that the market can do that the state can't do by central planning. So that's sort of some background behind... what I think Albert and Hanel tried to do, which was they tried to take the theory of economics, of market economics, which essentially tells you that markets make supply and demand equal, and then they tried to implement that as a way of, as the outcome of a plan instead of the outcome of a market. And so now there's the mechanism of how does the plan work. So we had all these demands and supplies, and then you had this thing called the Iteration Facilitation Board, and the reason it's called that will become clear in a second. And then what happens is that you have like these D1s, D2s, and then the S1s, you know, SNs, and then so they make a proposal. They take one of those, and then this Iteration Facilitation Board is just like a group of people that are sort of. That are supposed to just facilitate this process of taking what all the different councils have proposed, figuring out, is this feasible? If it's not feasible, you give out a price that sort of says, okay, now make your decisions in light of this information of the prices. Then the councils will make another round of demands and supplies, and then it'll go back to the Iteration Facilitation Board. And then they'll come back with another set of demands and with another set of price, and this will go back and forth until you've gotten that all the demands and all the supplies add up. Okay, please ask me a question about this, because I recognize that I've gone too fast.
At what level is this IFB operating?
It's economy-wide.
Okay,
good question. So the idea is that you can have a bunch of different IFBs for any particular local economy, but as soon as you have spillovers happening, you need another IFB to coordinate those sort of economic interactions between like two disjoint cities, say, right? So, you know, if you wanted to do international trade in a paracon, you'd need to have an iteration facilitation board that was of a layer higher than those two countries.
But they're not actually planning. It's actually the exchange of information between the different councils that's going on. They're just sort of facilitating that the debate is going on, presumably through Does it have to have computers to do this?
It probably will have computers in any sort of realistic thing. And I've actually played with implementing this on a computer. Yeah, big dork right here. It's kind of interesting. It's like, you know, it often just takes... Sometimes this can take a fabulously long time to converge to the, like, this process of they get a price, and then they get back another set of D's and S's, and then they get another, you know, P1 and then P2, and then you go back and forth. And then at some point, you'll get one where, you know, where the D1 plus D2 is equal to S1 plus S2. So do people understand how when I get a price, how do I get a new bunch of demands and supplies? They have another meeting, and then they all make new proposals based on this price. So this price is telling you how much of good X can you like, what's the relative proportions of a good that you can get for one unit of your labor?
I don't understand that. Is the price? I mean, are we talking about different prices for each?
Yeah. Sorry. This price is a list of prices. For every possible commodity. This can go on for some time, and then at some point it'll figure out a way in which demands and supplies are equal.
It's basically just through applying like a simple multiplier to the amount of weighted labor that went into each one, or how are the prices?
So they're computed by if the demand for a good exceeds the supply of the good. They make a small adjustment to the demand and supply.
Okay, per good.
Per good.
Based on supply
and
demand.
And they add it up, and then they send out those new prices,
okay.
And then they sort of make those adjustments. But there's, like, a lot of different stuff you can do, and there's a lot of different mathematical stuff you can do to get the right price to come out of this.
So there's a new price, or there's a new demand and supply configured because once the community knows the price of things, they may want more of it because the price is low,
or they
may want
less of the stuff that's too pricey.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm just trying to think of, like, the market-based arguments against this,
mm-hmm.
And as I did very poorly in my own economics class, this is going to come out probably pretty rough, but how do we know that people's demands as stated would actually correspond to their real market behavior if there was a real market, in the sense that people say, sure, we want world peace, and we'd never buy, you know, we never support Nestle if we knew it killed a bunch of kids, but in reality, they do that all the time. So how's that dealt with, if at all?
Well, these are sort of what you would actually get. So there's no incentive to lie, because, you know, you're like, you're going to get what you ask for, in theory. So, you know, if world peace is a thing in here, you're going to be coughing up for world peace.
How often is this process supposed to take place?
Well, so this was my first debate with Michael Albert. I was like, I just don't believe that this is as responsive and as fast as markets. Even though markets are bad at doing lots of things, they are fast for some stuff. You know, like a Radio Shack sees that there's a fire in Thailand and their chips are, like, now going to be double the prices, and they just double the prices the next day. Well, you know, this process could. So they say once a year at the beginning of every year, and that it would and they build in some slack to accommodate. Things that were out of the ordinary that happened over the course of the year.
This reminds me of those cell phone commercials where they have the kids and they're like, oh, you've gone over your basketball minutes. Like, do you have to, like, calculate, like, you know, like, your food supply for the next year and be and have it, like, if you've underestimated your...
Well, the slack would presumably do that, but yeah, that's sort of the you know, and that's their first... Their first response to that is, no, you know, you can build in some stuff where, you know, you can go get a liter of milk and eggs and stuff every week, and that's part of the slack, but you're going to have to know generally, you're going to have to make a projection about how much, you know, cereal are you going to eat.
So every household does that, like, sits down and says, here are the things that I want in the coming year?
Yeah, and then bring that to their consumption council and say, this is what we need, and here's how much we're willing to work for it.
So where does it all? Where do the goods go? Where do you get them? How do you get them?
This is a good question. There's no reason you couldn't have shopping malls. It's just, and the way that you buy things, though, is just isn't, and there could even be money. But it's just that the way those prices are set are not by markets, that the prices are set by this process. And what determines how much money you have isn't how much you own, it's how much labor your fellow coworkers have decided that you that you deserve. Yeah.
Are you going to break that down too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like which part of that?
The labor.
Oh, right.
How you determine your units of.
Okay,
things?
So, yeah. This is another big open thing in their model, is that what happens is that what you get from your workplace council is sort of a bunch of. Everybody sort of says, here's how much I'm willing to work, but your actual payment is determined at a council meeting where your fellow coworkers say, all right, we sort of feel like you've worked 10 effort units or $10, we'll say, worth of stuff, and that's all you can do. That's sort of your, yeah?
Essentially, there was with the bounce job complex, time basically became like, because there was no real difference in the effort of jobs, so basically you could just clock your hours as really being, and that sort of there was some discretion of your coworkers if, you know, you were a big slacker or something like that, but for the most part, it was just sort of hour for hour was.
That might be, I'm not familiar with that, because I think they recognize that, you know, even among different job ratings and stuff, that there still could be people that just work really, really hard, and some people that don't work so hard, and even at the finest level of divvying up these balanced job complexes, you could still have sort of a bundle of jobs that was qualitatively harder than another. So I think that the room for discretion is pretty large, which I think is kind of problematic. Is that clearer? Marginally?
This is vaguely like discussing some form of insanity, as if everybody's perfectly sane, but... you know, assuming that you have time enough from your job and the meetings to think about this, is there like another set of firm consumer councils and firm worker councils and firm IFBs and everything to deal with capital goods and so on? So you have like nested meetings within meetings and no one can change their mind except at the end of the year, like health plans.
So I think they're a little bit more flexible than that. They say that, you know, one of the things you compute at your workplace council meeting every year is, what are your capital requirements? What are your ideas for new projects to start? How much in the way of raw materials do you need? And then they sort of say that, you know, at one of these consumer council meetings that entrepreneurs, those lions of industry, could come and make
proposals.
Yeah, sorry. Right. that people that wanted to start new businesses or new workplace councils and stuff could come and make a proposal and ask for money to ask for some council to divert some of their resources towards funding this project. Helpful?
So you've got the households have decided they weren't likely to have so much milk and cereal for the course of the year, and the community as such as a whole decides the equivalent of our consumer co-op board, in effect, decides this is how much milk we'll likely need this year, and the farmers will decide, say, this is how much milk we can provide this year, but they also have to say this is how much we need in order to get, we need new cows. That's there, that's the consumer, that's the capital goods parts. They're also making a demand of what they need. And so that's all got to be balanced together.
Right. So
all those three things. Yeah.
Yeah, there comes another bunch of demands from each of the firms for stuff, and they just get added into it.
Cattle growers have got to say, this is how many cows we can develop to provide for the dairy farmers.
But all of that, sorry, I should have been clear about this, but... So firms can also propose a demand of stuff that they need.
Right.
And so those demands just get added onto the consumer demands when we're computing sort of what the prices should
be. That's why the iteration is, why it goes back and forth, because in order to have so much milk, we need so many cows.
Well,
if we're going to have that much milk, we need be sure we have these many cows.
You need iteration even if you didn't have that, because you'd need to sort of find some way of these councils sort of getting all of their proposals into order so that these suppliers could produce that which was demanded by the consumers.
Like a vicious feedback or something where...
Virtuous feedback.
Well, I know, but the thing is that I'm just thinking of the iterations where, you know, there's, okay, you know, like I'm a dairy farmer and my price of grain keeps going up and down to feed the cows. And so the amount of new cows I can get for the next year to produce the milk changes every time the price of grain changes. And so when the iteration goes through, the S's change at the same time as the D's change. And
yeah, this is the beauty of simultaneous equations, is that you can solve them all. yeah, and that's sort of what you're winding looking for, is that this is essentially becomes one big set of, you know, you get an equation for every single good that says here's how much supplied, here's how much is demanded. And then we just, you know, this process is essentially just computing it's just essentially a computer algorithm for computing that price, which will make that total supply equal to that total demand. And magically, I guess it works, I guess. So are there any more, are there questions still? Yeah?
What happens if things went horribly wrong? That just the buildup of inaccuracies in the calculations just is such that there's a massive shortage of an essential good.
So that's, I've wondered that too. So I've, so one of the things I played with is that there's a theorem that you can show that this supply and demand function is chaotic in general, like that it's, if you just sort of took an arbitrary number of people with sort of, and gave them, said that you could want anything in the world. And then you sort of was like, okay, now given these arbitrary people with arbitrary preferences over stuff, will this process work? And it turns out generically, no, because a small mistake anywhere along this way could blow up into gigantic errors down here. That's a problem I have with this, is that that could happen. And I don't know how often it would happen in practice, but you know, it sort of depends if what people want sort of looks the same across people. So I think this would work great for milk, because milk doesn't, you know, people just want, or sorry for the vegans in the room, say buckwheat husks. or rice or something, where it's like, you know, pretty much everybody can consume only so much rice. And let's say everybody only wants so much rice, then computing this price will be fairly straightforward. You don't have to worry about it massively distorting stuff.
But what about in the event of some sort of ecological catastrophe? You know, there's some sort of, you know, bug that eats all the rice, mm-hmm. one year, but it's already been pre-calculated.
Well, so presumably that farmers, I think they make some reliance that farmers can sort of insure themselves, like they can make a projection that's like, it's what we're likely to have, but we might want to build in so much slack in the odd case of a locust invasion. And so I think that's part of what would go into it, is building the slack, which, you know, so much stuff is going into the slack that you wind up thinking, this is going to be looking a lot like we're just having markets in slack. And there's a small part that's planned, and everything else is slack, and then we just wind up looking like going to the corner store for everything. Anyway, maybe. More questions. It took me a long time to understand this, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's more questions. But, yeah.
What about sectors of the economy that aren't, like, exactly, that aren't, like, you know, buying a particular commodity that I think you're hinting towards, this, like entertainment, like, you know, say going to see a concert or like going to, how does that work into the...
Well, how does it work under capitalism?
I mean, I think it's more by markets, like, and so would there be like acceptable things where like certain parts, you know, certain sectors of the economy would be organized in, you know, with workers' councils and consumers' councils, but other things that are just sort of slightly more spontaneous, per se.
I think would it would be something like that, but what that spontaneousness looks like, I don't know. They don't go into that very much. It could either look like you call, like, oh my God, Motley Crue's coming to town. We need to have an emergency consumer council meeting to decide who gets tickets. it might look like that, or it might look like, oh, you're doing something with this Slack that you're allowed to trade off some of your excess labor that you haven't allocated at the beginning of the year towards your Motley Crue tickets. Apologies to Motley Crue fans.
Well, there's a certain amount of disposable extra
income. Yeah, but again, like, that could be huge.
And, yeah, well, for entertainment, it should be huge in a free society.
Of production beyond demand?
That would be, again, Slack.
And then what happens to those, you know, you have X, you know, tons of rice that are extra just in case that don't end up being demanded? What happens?
Well, I think that's the kind of stuff that happens under capitalism. You send out big boats full of rice in the middle of the ocean and sink them.
Right, and is that what
happened under Paragon?
Well, presumably, you know, I don't see if there wasn't a problem, if everybody was getting fed and there was no wastage and all the, you know, and we had thought of every possible use of extra rice we could have thought of, including those little pillows that you fit around your neck, and that's a big thing. Yeah, right. And then we were like, we still have leftover rice. I don't think I'd have a particular problem with sending the boat into the middle of the ocean and sinking it. Or firing it to the moon or something. compost, right. Compost it. Yeah.
What if you want to write a novel?
You'd apply for a grant from your consumer council.
Are services also priced according to this?
Yeah. So part of the workplace councils are also like things like, you know, massage therapists and why don't I come up with the most bizarre economic example?
Because that's what I do.
What about stuff that's not typically thought of as work right now, like paid work out in the economy? What about stuff that, I mean, does he make a distinction between like what's paid work, like, you know, caring for an elderly person as an orderly in a nursing home as opposed to caring for an elderly person at home who's related to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're really problematic on this because they think that that should go through the same process of getting monetized through the iterated planning process. But like you've talked about before, this would then destroy so much of the motivation that makes taking care of your relatives and stuff, that's why you do it, is because you're not getting paid.
Are you sure?
Well, in a lot of cases, let me give an example of this, that when people can pay for stuff, it often destroys the intrinsic motivation to do it. Like, the example is Israeli daycare. In Israel, they had this system of daycare where it was really bad that people's kids got, you know, what would happen, people show up late and their kids, the daycare workers would have to stay there late and take care of those kids until the parents got there. And this was considered a pretty big problem. And then what they did was they tried instituting a fine on the parents to do that, and it actually turned out that the parents were just willing to pay the fine and then let the daycare, and then they just sort of saw the fine as like a price to pay on that. And so then they didn't feel any sort of social obligation to show up on time to pick up their kids, and so they were just like, oh, I'm paying for it. And the similar thing works the other way. It's also when you pay... So, actually, this is way more complicated than that, because it's actually, like, with nurses and stuff, if you pay them a low wage, you get really bad nursing often. But you often don't, because you're sort of exploiting those person's natural altruism and sort of willingness to take care of people. But then that leads to burnout a lot, is what I've read on this. So I don't really know. That's my guess, is that that if you take all the stuff that's done in the household and make it for pay, that wouldn't be the greatest looking world.
Okay, but how do you like in this model? I missed part in the beginning, but I think I'm kind of following. How do you recognize specific work, like mostly done by women, like housework and like nurturing and taking care of kids and like sick people and da da da, and that hopefully in like a perfect society would be super well shared between like genders and stuff, but right now it's not mm-hmm. so much shared. So how do you take that in consideration, and what you just portrayed as, like, you think that paying some for something takes the motivation out, or the possibility of paying for some service?
Yeah, I think some of that happens. But so again, the way that Auburn have now proposed it is that it would just get locked in here, that you would make a work that, you know, you would get rated on your work by other people taking care of your kids, or some process would be developed that you would get rated on your work in caretaking or nurturing, and then you would get paid in proportion to that amount of work.
And why do you see a problem with that?
I'm just not sure that the act of paying, that when I'm not sure if this stuff would be vulnerable to the same sort of commodification of human affection and stuff like that. That I don't know, that there's just some evidence that points that when you do have some of this human affection for money stuff, it sort of reduces the quality of the human affection. But we would like it to get compensated in other ways, I agree. I'm just, you know, I just don't know.
Sorry, the last thing on it, it's just that, like, women's unpaid work is not necessarily human affection.
It's often exploitation. I don't know when at some point, you know, taking care of someone winds up being taking advantage of someone.
Do you want somebody to come into the house? I don't want anybody coming in and saying, well, you know, you could have worked harder on that dinner. Because you know, I do all the cooking and all the laundry and everything. And you know, I'm not sure I want that subjected to any kind of cash nexus.
It's not.
I mean, it's got to be recognized in some way, sure. But, you know, this, I think this system of having it rated by some other people who say, okay, well, this is so many work units you put in for dinner.
Could you talk more about who rates the work and how that's achieved? Because that seems...
Sure, do you want to finish this?
Yeah, I just wanted to answer one thing, and I don't think I'm following everything as well as she is, because we missed the first half, but I don't think we were talking about housework or making dinner. Mm-hmm. Like,
okay.
I think more like societal caregiving roles that are often allocated to women that are sometimes commodified and sometimes mm-hmm. just seen as a woman's responsibility. I think that's more, I don't know if that's what your original question was,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't thinking really about vacuuming or...
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But
my take on this has been that, I mean, I've seen the same problem. I like spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, wages for housework issue and also just, you know, the caregiving roles of women. And like, the solution on the one hand is to do, like they're saying here, is to, like, you know, commodify everything and say, mm-hmm. you know, even if we don't actually pay for everything, we value everything. And I kind of don't like that. And instead of this model of, like, taking, I guess I go like way farther than a lot of people on this. I just say, like, I kind of see, you know, the base economy that the capitalist, and to me that's the same as the patriarchal system, has come in and kind of like gobbled up bigger and bigger pieces of our social interactions and made them money transactions. I kind of like, I don't want to start paying for women's work. I want to start taking men's work out of the money economy as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like the alternate solution for me, which is a fairly abstract thing, but I don't like the idea of commodifying and even trying to put a dollar value on people's caregiving work. So, but I mean, my
campfire discussion.
Yeah, right. But I mean, like, I'm talking about going totally radically in the other direction too, which is like equally you know, unworkable in some ways.
Wayne?
Well, first of all, I think that a society that's capable of overthrowing capitalism and replacing it with some kind of cooperative economy hopefully would have begin to address the gender differentials in power and work.
How?
Well, how would they overthrow capitalism and
no.
replace it?
How could this and how could
the one translate into the other?
Well, I'm just assuming a vast transformation of society and great upheavals and so forth. Not saying this is a simple matter. I'm just saying that I assume big changes, not that, you know, when they're making big changes in one area and everything else is going to stay exactly the same, which makes it hardly worthwhile, to say the least. partly I think this is getting a little bit too, I mean, I would imagine that different groups would experiment with different things. Certainly the person staying home with the elderly aunt, let's say, or whether it's handled communally, and communally could just mean in the neighborhood, in the extended social family kind of thing. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to send old Aunt Sarah off to the equivalent of a socialist retirement home on the other side of the continent.
It's a work camp.
And certainly people in the community would say, well, we need a certain amount of resources to take care of our elderly and our sick and so forth. And that'll be one of the demands you make. And resources include that people should have a certain amount of credit for doing a certain amount of labor. I don't think by that it means that you can judge how hard you work on making dinner, how hard you work at taking care of Aunt Sarah. It means that we assume a certain amount of hours for which people, you know, it takes on the average, and people should be prepared to be paid more or less, you know, on this, and whether they work, you know, and how much. I don't think any credit for being friendly or affectionate to Aunt Sarah or not. That's my impression, is that people who do things out of love or affection or duty would be perfectly happy to be paid for it, to get anything extra for it. They do it in spite of not being paid. That's quite a different matter from getting a job somewhere to do something. If they got money to help tear and had respites and so forth, that's a different.
I like that. Like, I wish that there's just a lot of evidence that I can't think of it.
You're comparing it to getting a job somewhere with some total strangers. That's different.
Okay.
From taking care of Aunt Sarah, but you don't have to work, but you're still being paid,
but you're
still getting money,
like,
and a stipend and a respite and so forth.
That's fair.
Two things. The first one is that I think to assume, too, that in this society, right now that we're living in, that people who take care of Aunt Sarah aren't, some people are expecting some kind of financial gain when Aunt Sarah dies anyway. So, like, to say that they're doing it all out of the goodness of their heart, some of them are not, you know? So, like, I don't know if this is all. But is there an estimate about how many hours they think people would need to work? Like, do they have any kind of...
No, it would depend on what people demand. It's like, if we're willing to go small scale on our demands, then people aren't going to be working a lot. If we want... I've often made the case that under, you know, socialism, we should have a fatter catalog than capitalism. That's the only way we're going to sell it, is that it's going to be bigger than Sears, the amount of stuff you can get. But, you know, I'm a minority. Barbara?
Well, I'm just going to raise another topic. Maybe it's been addressed before, and it's the case, just tell me that I'll just stop. But, is this system or model only applicable, like locally or regionally, or like in some kind of bigger territory, like a nation, or, well, whatever we want to call it? Or does it have to be international to work? Because if it doesn't have to be international, it raises the second question of, like, well, too, how do we relate to other economic systems out there? And the other one is, like, you know, the free trade theory, the basic one, like, how do you get the... Comment tu traduis la théorie des avantages comparatifs?
Comparative advantage, yeah.
Okay, well, so... how do you deal with that? Like, not that I want to go with this theory necessarily, but, like, just getting things that we can't produce here. Because, we don't necessarily need them. Should we want them? Or should we not want them because we can't have them, you know?
Well,
I'm a papaya.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the it's okay to have international economic transactions sort of school. It's like, yes, papayas. Great. We can ship pine wood back. Sustainably, of course. So there's two ways. One is, yeah, you can implement this at any sort of scale, and then the question comes up, what if, you know, Quebec or Newfoundland becomes a paracon?
Newfoundland?
I'm from Newfoundland. becomes a paracon, and then how does it mediate with the rest of the world that hasn't yet seen the light? One of the things is it would set up like something like how to translate its prices into market prices in Ontario, say, and you know, would have to deal with the fact that its prices are probably going to face very different conversions when you move over the border. That, you know, what we value here is going to be valued a lot differently over there, and that's going to really change whether we can buy some of the stuff that we want. I actually think international trade could really undermine this, because, you know, if
you're go buy it in Ontario.
Yeah. exactly. Although Michael Albert and Robin Hanel would say, why would you give up your great socialist workplace to go to buy it just for cheap bananas? But I'm like, people often do that. It's like, so yeah, I don't know if that.
I don't know if you've already talked about this too, so just stop me if you have, but work is going to be rated by a collective, that's the idea. What's the decision-making process? Do you go into that, and who's represented? And, like,
they don't go into that. And they're just saying that there's going to be some sort of democratic decision-making process that'll work great all the time. this is where I have another huge problem with these folks. And so the thing is that would make sort of all of your economic life subject to the whim of the petty personal politics of your workplace council, which, ew. You know, as anyone who has been part of a collective is just like, it can often get icky. And can you just imagine when that dictates what you can buy for the next year? That's not pleasant. But there is something about that they sort of say that one of the sort of constitutional clauses of this is that nobody can. The council has no power to let you buy less than what your workplace council gives you as your work rating. So if you can get things right in the workplace councils, the consumer councils can't really do anything about it. But you still have, you know, have all this. Imagine if somebody started sleeping with somebody else in the workplace council. That just exploded into factions. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Just,